Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've got 10 minutes for questions.
Scott, if you could talk about what was your timeline for recognition of problems to coming up with a plan, convincing management, and going forward with the plan and actually achieving the results.
Right, okay. I recognised the problems at the college before I got there because it was the laughing stock with us at the other colleges. Like, you know, so I was quite sort of aware the problems were there. But having said that, at a previous college I've worked at, I'd faced a similar situation where it said poor inspection. And I was given the marketing team on the day that the regional newspaper's front page headline to, you know, so many hundred thousand hours, it was college's worst for A levels, and that was the headline. So I suppose I'd already done it before, so at the point I took up the job at Sandwell, I pretty much knew what I wanted to do when I got there. So probably within the sort of the first sort of 6-8 months, we'd worked out that the marketing team as was probably weren't going to survive the course. We had to reduce the budget because of the financial problems, but that was easy because so much of it was being wasted, which I mentioned earlier on, you know, but just being thrown with a shotgun rather than a sniper rifle, you know. And probably within it probably took about 12 months to get them to drop that nasty little paragraph on the end of all the press coverage. And by about 18 months, we'd started to turn the college round. I mean, we did one thing, which was, I mentioned that one of the campuses was particularly dire. It looked like a Victorian workhouse. So we'd got a November open evening come up. So we got a paranormal investigation society in and ran a ghost walk around this campus. And, OK, it was a dump and it looked like it was haunted, but that was exactly what I needed at that point, to run a ghost walk for the local community. And all the staff got dressed up as skeletons and things and whatever. But the people coming out were going, fantastic, I know the building's dire, but your staff are great, like, you know, and my kids have enjoyed it and things like that. So you've got to look at what, you know, positive you can get out of anything, no matter how dire it is. So probably within about 18 months, things had started in an upward trajectory.
Thank you. Don't forget, if you're online, to use the submit a question to the chair button. Perfect timing.
Scott's very popular on the internet. I have three questions for him. Do you want them one at a time or three together? I'll go one at a time then. Okay, the first question is from Jane Camfield. Her question is, interesting to hear you had a huge marketing budget and you decided to cut it down. May I ask, what was the budget? What do you call huge? And why did you think this was the way forward?
Can I use the actual figures, I suppose? I mean, I don't know what you've all got, and you might think the new one's still huge, but if I looked at the things that we're actually spending on press, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think back. I think when I first got there, they'd thrown something like 780,000 at stuff like that, and I've got it down to about 284 now.
Okay, the next question is from Katie Clark at Gateshead College. She asks, can you give more details as to how you arrange the free travel pass to all students?
When EMA was dropped, that hit our students particularly hard because the bulk of our students qualified for EMA, genuinely. We had some money through the new discretionary grant that you get from the government, but that replaced only about a third of the money that the students had been claiming in EMA with the grant that we got. So we decided at the time we'd use the whole of that grant plus a little bit extra from the college resources to make sure that everybody got a free travel pass. And really, we were only sort of, you know, painted in the corner for the 1 year, because the next year the recruitment had leapt up that much that it was affordable at that point.
And finally, a question from Samantha of the Stockton Sixth Form College. Do you have any advice with regards to getting that 60% middle section of staff on board and bought into your programme of change?
Be honest and make sure that things actually happen. with all these sort of change programs, there'll be a period right at the front end where it looks as though nothing's happening. But stuff is happening, but it's happening, you know, under the surface, or it's happening internally rather than, you know, the public aren't seeing that. So it's lots of sort of little wins. But paint that corridor, you know, put a few extra computers in that open learning centre and whatever. You've got to show people that things are actually moving forward, even if it's part of some enormous grand plan. You can't beat having a couple of sort of little wins. And you know, it's sort of thing. You've got to be out there talking to people. If you sit in your office or you're out externally all the time, how do you know what's riling the staff? You've got to walk around the corridors and take it on the chin when people go, "My classroom is like a Victorian toilet because it floods every time it rains and whatever." And then, you know, chip away at those little things to try and it doesn't. That is not a long process. As soon as a couple of things start happening like that, you're building up your advocates within the staff.
Any more? I have a quick question about HE. Now, there's a big bit of controversy here because HE, principals tend to tell me that it can grow by 500% or 600% in 5 minutes. And there is clearly potential for growth, and it's faster than the potential for growth for 16 to 18. Do you think, therefore, that in order to enable your marketing department to capture that growth and do that work, HE should sort of fund its marketing from its own anticipated revenue so that it's not raiding your core recruitment business?
It's a really interesting question. I think that I wouldn't distinguish the HE marketing from the FE marketing in terms of reputation. And to go back to a point I made, I think it's really important to see your internal market from your own students, to be part of that. By and large, if you are running quite a bit of HE and you are charging above 6,000, HE is likely to be a net contributor. So you're likely actually to be having HE contributing to the FE reputation and marketing budget as well. So I'm not so sure about that. I think what's key, though, is about who your market is likely to be. And, you know, it's a bit like what Scott was saying about being very targeted and working out where you're likely to attract those marketing, those new markets or those new students from in your locality. And having a lot of that builds on your reputation and your collaboration. So if you have good relationships, and this can be a challenge if you don't, then quite often you'll be able to get into those schools that perhaps won't let you in for FE. They'll let you into the sixth form or the sixth form colleges to actually talk about what opportunities there are locally for their students to go to your for HE. So I actually think if you use those networks, you don't necessarily need to be promoting a lot of putting a lot of the budget in, and I would say that because I'm a principal, so I'm always keeping an eye on the budget. But you know, I think there's quite a lot to be done with that. I think the other thing is social media is very powerful, and the key information set is very powerful. And, you know, we're being dictated to, I think, by government about what public information is there. So if you look at FE Choices, if you look at the key information set, that whole arena of public information is... You know that it's being directed to us, and I think it's our opportunity to actually try and shape that while it's being formed, and use our websites in particular to actually augment that and make sure the key messages come out. And I think that's really important.
Thank you. Right, we've got time to squeeze in one more question and one pithy answer. I think Justin had your hand up first. Sorry, Penelope.
Justin Rollings again. Hi. Sue, just following on from the HE and your experience at your college, for us it's a little bit of a dilemma again about differentiation between our FE students and our HE students. The only difference, if you like, is that our HE students can use a lift and our FE students can't. I just wondered if you have a similar sort of problem, you know, within your campus about how you make a clear differentiation between the two. Do you give your HE students a little bit extra, I don't know, you know, extracurricular activities or something else to give them that better experience that they would expect to get at university?
Yeah. Well, we're fortunate because we have the volumes. We actually have a university centre. But knowing colleagues who have smaller provision, one of the things they manage to... One of the things that's key is access. So actually access to research facilities and support for research, I think, is one of the ways that you can create that. And the second way is about a community, an HE community. So making sure that students are in touch with each other and feel special. And I think using the lift might be one way of doing it, but there are better ways.
Thank you. time for lunch, and we're back at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.